Hey Blenders, on this week's show, Christopher Nolan has a new studio. The Eyes of Tammy Faye drops this week, and we also have director Michael Showalter on to talk about the film.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 182 of Real Blend, a podcast that's really been a deep fake all along. On this week's show, Christopher Nolan lands a new studio. So long, Warner Brothers, and hello, Universal. The Eyes of Tammy Faye is going to be dropping, and we're going to have director Michael Showalter, who worked on The Big Sick, but also directed The Eyes of Tammy Faye, as this week's guest on The Real Blend Show, which is co-hosted each and every week by Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev.
Sean, Jake, Gabriel, good to see you guys.
Good to have you back, my friend.
Gabe got it.
And Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jakey.
Sean, you have a second-place glow about you, sir.
We have the same record, Jake. That's it. That's all.
I didn't say that as a slight. I meant it as you and I are atop our fantasy league, sir.
Jake and I are in the same fantasy football league, and we both dominated. We might have the two best squads in the...
Give me a high five.
In the entire division. There we go. High five.
Yeah.
Until we play each other. Housekeeping.
Oh, could you... I looked it up. I think it's like week 7, so we have some time. But, week.
Yeah, we got to put a good bet down on that one.
Think about it.
If you're watching us on YouTube, hello. Nice to see you guys. Make sure you go down. Hit subscribe. Turn on new notifications. We post Happy all of our full related. Shows here, and we also have video interviews with the people who are nice enough to stop by. If you want to join us and you have not been over to that page, it's youtube.com/realblendpodcast. Of course, we're available all the different places where you get your audio podcast needs met. Have you signed up yet for Real Blend Premium? And if you haven't, why the heck not? Because every week you get a Monday show, an additional show from us with some fun games that are usually involved in it. You get a newsletter written by me every other week, and an ad-free experience. All right, to get the premium episode, go to cinemablend.com/realblendpremium. I think it's worth signing up for. It's usually entertaining. Like this show, it's usually entertaining. Kev, we're going to go to the weekly poll, because this is a movie that it's dropped a little bit of a bomb in the middle of the Real Blend text thread.
Right.
Because of our reactions to it. This is James Wan's film, Malignant, which came out last week. And it was on HBO Max, and it's in theaters, and it has some complicated plot twists, which we are not going to get into right here. But I wanted to, or actually Gabe put this one together, and he said, what did you think of Malignant? Kev, I want you to answer what you think our audience said, and then I want to hear from you. Okay. We gave them the option of James Wan's best, a good horror flick, Wasn't For Me, or Too Scared to Press Play. Mm. Where do you think the people went?
I'm going
to
guess our audience went with a good horror flick.
Okay. Close. Wasn't For Me got 42%.
Mm.
And a good horror flick got 32%.
Okay.
So close. Yeah, pretty close. Okay. 13% went with James Wan's best. And that's interesting. That's interesting. I don't know if I'd go that route. But Kev, take it away. What did you think of Malignant? And we're going to keep it spoiler free.
I mean, I absolutely loved it. At the end of the day, I think the camera work in this movie is absolutely beautiful. And like one of the things that James Wan does brilliantly, and you can see this in The Conjuring, and you can see this obviously in a lot of his films, primarily in The Conjuring, is just the way he moves his camera. There's a way he shoots houses that is like so Wan-like in terms of the way he films that. But I loved not knowing where this movie was going. And I think that's kind of like the beauty of what this film did for me was, I mean, I'm telling you right now, that third act, which again, and then we were discussing this before the show, it's not a spoiler to say the third act is crazy. That's kind of been like the big selling point of this movie, is that don't spoil it for anybody. Don't say what it is. We're not going to say what it is. But it's an incredible third act, like, and it's insane. So
It is insane. And one of the things that I find so intriguing about it is that I was a little bit giving James Wan a hard time going into it with the marketing of, like, if you don't show it to people or you hold the embargo the night before, people have become really sophisticated with the fact that that might mean it's really bad. But that's not the case with this. And I do think that some people who are judging it as like over the top and corny, I think they're missing the fact that he did all of that on purpose.
Purposeful, yes. Like, yeah, what you're referring to.
That's what I think is so masterful about it.
I agree with you. Like, there's a camp element to this film that is designed, I believe, on purpose. Like, as I was watching the first two acts of this movie, every single decision that came off, quote unquote, like campy or cheesy, I felt was a director choice. I didn't feel that it was like bad acting or like bad script writing. I genuinely thought everything was designed in a way for you to be taken on a different ride in terms of horror. And like, I had never seen a film like this before in terms of the horror genre. And that's why I use the Upgrade example, that because Lee Whannell, for people who aren't aware, Lee Whannell and James Wan, they came up together. They did Saw together. And then Lee Whannell went on to do amazing films like The Invisible Man. But in this particular instance, I've never seen horror used in this particular way. And it's so incredibly smart and unique and fun. And I'm glad it wasn't ruined for anybody. And that's kind of why we're not ruining it for people, because it's genuinely surprising, shocking, and just downright awesome. It's an awesome horror film. It's very well done.
I think he sets the tone of it too in the opening 5 minutes.
100%. Like, yeah.
Like, that scene is so off the charts, gonzo and funny.
That it almost feels like Sam Raimi doing Evil Dead.
Yes.
Malignant is just on a different scale. It's just masterful in terms of the way he works that camera. Wan is so good.
It feels a little bit like you would call it like a student film.
Yeah.
You know, or a first time filmmaker trying everything. But it's made by someone who is a master at the field.
Sure,
agree with you 100%.
There's a
master class
sequence
to
where
it.
Someone's escaping a building and is leaving out the fire exit. Where you just go like, okay, I can call this movie a B movie all day long. I was watching it and thinking, oh, this is him doing like a wacky B movie. But then there are some sequences, some tracking shots, some exterior shots where you just go like, this ain't shot like a B movie. Like, it might meant to be written like a B movie. It might made to be felt like a B movie, but it's made like an A movie, and it's made by a director who knows how to make an A movie. That being said,
yeah, this is I'm the conversation. Go ahead.
I'm not sure it's actually a good, like, look, I had a blast. I had a ton of fun. When the third act hit and I realized where we were at, I just threw my arms up in the air and went, cool, let's do this. Let's go fucking nuts. You're like, you want to get nuts? Let's go nuts. I'm not sure it's particularly a good movie, though. Like, and here's what sort of bums me out about it. Like, had fun. Super glad I watched it. Really cool. Not sure, like, I'd pop it on again. Like, when you know, I do horror. Of all of his movies, like, I've watched his first Conjuring 1,000 times. I would turn on Saw 1,000 times. I have Insidious on my list of like movies I want to rewatch in October, because I do a different horror movie every night. I feel like I'm kind of good on Malignant. I just the camp was a little too much. Like, I agree with you, Kevin, in that, like, I think a lot of the lines and the decisions and like the zoom in on the murder weapon and all that, like, was all on purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was still, it was just too much for me to enjoy.
Well, it was cool because for me, and I saw someone tweet about this, like this is a filmmaker who is, I would argue, past making this type of film in their career, if that makes sense. But to utilize the tools this filmmaker has and the ability of the budget that he's able to get because of the films that he's made, there's something special about watching a guy essentially make what would come off maybe as like a first or second movie in a filmography, but make it like with tools that are absolutely insane to use. And like, it was almost like watching a kid just kind of play in a candy store. And he was just like, you know, playing around with all the different things that he, and to me, like, the brilliance of it is that it is it is all thought out. It is all planned. It is all meant to be the way it is. I mean, I don't know. To me, it was just, I love that it came out of nowhere. I knew nothing about it. I just popped up one day and we were talking about it on here. Like, oh, Juan is a brand new movie out called Malignant. Yeah. Cool. And then there's obviously Dario Argento references and elements like that. I mean, to me, like, if you haven't like seen Suspiria, like the original Suspiria, like there's so many like interesting elements here that Juan is playing with, where he's paying homage to classic horror, but making a film on a level of a filmmaker that we haven't seen make a movie like this before. It was really cool.
I'm going to go one step further. This is going to be on a level for me of From Dusk Till Dawn. I want to show it to people who have never seen it.
That Dusk Till Dawn's a great way to put that. Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah, but this is From Dusk Till Dawn is so much better written.
Oh, I mean, yes. I mean, yes. It was Tarantino. It's, I mean, of course, but
I'll grant you that.
But it's still
I get the comparison, yeah. But I think are you saying that they're on the same level in terms of quality?
No. I'm saying part of the fun of going back to Malignant is going to be bringing someone who has no idea what it is.
But also, like, the Dusk Till Dawn was a good reference because, like for example, the bit of like going through Quentin's hand to see a shot or something like that. Yeah. Like it's goofy, but it's all done in the world. And I think that I would argue that From Dusk Till Dawn is probably a really good tonal example of what Malignant kind of plays with in terms of like different styles of horror, because Dusk Till Dawn's two movies at the end of the day. You know, it's a crime thriller about two people going across the country and murdering people, and then turns into a horror film at the end of the movie. And I think Malignant just kind of goes insane with its material.
Let me ask you something. Up until the third act gets crazy, what did you think of the film?
I dug it. That was the thing.
Really? I was in before the third act to save it.
See, what's interesting is the third act was almost like the sprinkles on top of the ice cream, and the sprinkles taste damn good. I enjoy I was already digging the even though you eat the sprinkles first, like it doesn't make sense because you
to get the ice cream. I'm following you.
But you know what I mean. But I mean, in terms of like, there was something about the third act that just complemented the whole piece, and it just brought the piece together. And I was in before the shift, and like, and it's a very, very obvious and gigantic shift this movie then takes. But it works for me. I don't know. I thought it was a very good movie. I definitely don't look at it just as like a piece of camp. I thought it was a solid horror film.
It's clearly made by someone that just made a studio a $1 billion superhero movie and said, "This is what I want to do. I dare you to
tell
me no."
And his thing too is he could just do Aquaman movies for the next 10 years if he wanted to, and do nothing in between.
He did this in between just to play. Just like, he literally woke up probably was like, "You know what? I want to make a really cool horror film." I'm just gonna knock it out before I do Aquaman 2. I mean, this movie came out of nowhere. Did you guys know anything about this film until a couple weeks ago?
Not really. No, not really. One film that we do know a lot about is The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Especially for me down here in Charlotte. I mean, Jake, you were saying the fact that you weren't that familiar with the story beforehand.
Yeah,
I
didn't know who she was, and particularly based on having seen the film now, when I realized when it took place, I'm like, okay, it kind of makes sense why.
Yeah.
I didn't really hear about this story.
They were like tabloid fodder on a national level, to the way that like O.J. Simpson was for a period of time, especially like during his trial. Like when they were getting into all of their scandals and a lot of stuff that the film to me didn't get that deep into. I mean, a lot of stuff happens to Jim Baker, and it put the two of them front and center on things like the National Enquirer. Not quite, Time and People, but like but the supermarket tabloids, basically. So Michael Showalter is tackling this story with Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield, and he was nice enough to come by the show to sit down for a Real Blend interview. So without further ado, the Real Blend interview with the Eyes of Tammy Faye director Michael Showalter. Well, I have to start here, though, Michael, because it's very rare I get a chance to do this, but I'm actually based in beautiful Charlotte, North Carolina, where you guys filmed. In the backyard of Jim and Tammy Faye. And so I just want to know, like, what filming here, being able to tell this story here in this location, how it impacted whatever prep you were doing, and then just, the production in general.
I mean, it was awesome. We got a chance to go and, like, walk around Heritage, the Heritage is right over the border in South Carolina. And so we got to go see a lot of where the actual story takes place. And then also just being in Charlotte, I mean, everybody has stories, you know, everybody of a certain age, either knew, you know, was their parents were PTL members, or they were PTL members, or they worked at Shoe Barn and Tammy Faye was a regular customer, or, you know, Dillard's, you know, she was a big shopper at Dillard's. And there's like that Italian restaurant in the mall that she was she goes to. We actually mentioned it in the movie.
Okay. Is that type of stuff just invaluable as when you're building a character and when you're building a world?
I think it helps you, you know, for me, I like, you know, to create like that. Like you said, you're building a world, you're sort of in make-believe land. And the more you feel like you're immersed in that, mm-hmm. the more lost in it you get. Mm-hmm. That being said, and so, I mean, it was amazing to be able to shoot the movie there in the South on these locations. And it's not just, you know, the houses or something, but it's even just the grass, the trees, the air. Mm-hmm. By the same token, having done many projects where we aren't where we are, you know, I just shot a TV show that's coming out soon that's set in New York City. We shot it in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
But there's something exciting too about creating an environment somewhere else too. You kind of build that world somewhere else. So it kind of goes both ways, mm-hmm. but I had an amazing time being in Charlotte, and not just for the way it, you know, just creatively, but also just, it's good to, you know, it's a fun town. Like I just, you know, we had our routine, we got our routines figured out and all that stuff.
Hmm. You know, Michael, I'm really fascinated in terms of filmmaking here because we're going in such an interesting timeline and we're watching the characters age. I was wondering, because you shoot movies non-linearly, generally speaking, and if you didn't do that here, I'd love to hear that. But I'm curious, were there days where Jessica and Andrew would be in multiple ages at one point in the day, and kind of how did you navigate that? Because they're both aging so much throughout the film.
Yeah. No, but it's a great question because of the prosthetics, they could only be in one age per day. So the amount of time it would take to have Jessica be Jessica in the 60s to then have her be Jessica in the 80s, we wouldn't have enough time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So she was always in one look on any given day.
Hmm. That probably helps emotionally, I would imagine, like in terms of her character arc, to be able to do it almost in order, basically, kind of, right?
But we definitely tried to shoot it as much in order as possible. And that definitely did. I do think that helped. I mean, I don't know if it helped. Yes. I mean, helped is a strange word. It was interesting to start the movie with them falling in love, and to see how that affects the vibe on set, which is like everyone's in a good mood, everybody's having fun, everybody's getting along. And then as the relationship starts to fall apart, all of a sudden it's kind of tense and everybody's not getting along so well and everyone's not in such a good mood. When you have actors like Jessica and Andrew who are, you know, so committed to the work they're doing, the experience of making the movie as you're going on the journey with these characters, there is a little bit of like, oh, this is like, we were having so much fun when they were like just on the road preaching, like, can't we go back to that? You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, now they're stressed out and they're estranged and problems are starting. And so you kind of feel the weight of that, but that's really cool. You know, like that's part of the process.
Well, and to that end, Michael, I'd love for you to talk about this, because prior to the movie finally being seen by people, I think we were curious as to how it was going to play, like what the tone of it was going to be. Because I feel like with this material, if you lean, you know, one direction or the other, it could be spoof if you wanted it to be, you know? And so could you talk about some of the conversations you maybe had with even Jessica as a producer, just for the tone you were shooting for and how you got to it?
Have you guys, I'm assuming you guys have seen the film.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, I think I always, I never, you know, I think we all agreed that it could be entertaining and it could be fun and funny at times, you know, some of the ridiculous outfits or the song, you know, the disco Jesus and that kind of thing.
Sure.
But we always knew that we didn't want it to be making fun of her or, being cartoonish or campy or any of those things. I think we all wanted that to explore these characters as real people and to allow them to have humanity and flaws and everything that comes with that. And so that's very much was the tone that we were attempting to achieve.
Cause I'm in my 40s and to me, the Bakers were tabloid fodder, you know, for so much of their existence. And it was halfway through the movie or towards the back half when my wife turned to me and she's like, I feel really bad for Tammy Faye. Like,
yeah,
that was the sentimentality that was brought forward right in the film.
She's a human being. She's different than the perception.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, Michael, I was interested in asking this because you have the makeup is so interesting in this film because it is so heavy in terms of what you have to do to the characters. And it looks so real as you're watching it, but you shoot digitally. And I wonder, like, when you shoot digitally and you actually have aspects of different time periods, were you adding grain at all to your film or to your movie to kind of give it a time period aspect? And was shooting digitally, since the cameras are so HD, was that ever a concern that we would see the makeup at all? Because as an audience member, you don't. But I wondered, in terms of the cameras, if that affected any choices you made in terms of post-production.
I'm going to quickly answer that question because I don't have I'm not so super knowledgeable on the technical side. We definitely added grain. And sort of shooting the makeup was always on our minds, you know, how to light it, how to shoot it, in any given scene, like how does the makeup look? I mean, and of course, digital touch-ups also, because there's certain scenes where, you know, on the day, we knew, oh, well, you can see a tiny crease there, or you can see a tiny piece of the prosthetic is like lifting up or something, but you just know that's going to get fixed digitally. And you kind of go in knowing, and the digital fixes isn't like, you know, it's not CGI. It's just a tiny little alteration gets made to hide, but that's any movie just about that has prosthetics is, you know, going in, you're going to do a fair amount of digital fixing, not unlike you would in a fashion magazine when you're doing a photo shoot and they're doing, you know, touch-ups in Photoshop. But going back to your other question about the spoof aspect of it, and you and your wife, were you expecting it to be a spoof? And, or were you hoping that it would be that, like when you went in, were you sort of like, oh, it's Michael Showalter, it's Tammy Faye Baker, I'm kind of hoping that it'll be like making fun of them. And then having to realize over the course of watching it, oh, it's not that. And I guess my question is like, at what point was it literally only until halfway through the movie before you realized that's not what it was going to be?
No, that's interesting. I think I might have jumped to the conclusion, not spoof, but more comedic. Maybe because of the marketing.
Like Tanya.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very like a little bit.
Well, because there's the relationship with the mom, you know, that's hinted at in the marketing and the difficulties that they were having being on the same page, and almost the mom being sort of judgmental of Tammy Faye, that almost passing a judgment of whatever Tammy Faye is trying to do. Like, she has that attitude of like, what did you get into now sort of thing.
Right, 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 right.
But I thought very early on, through the performances and even through the way that you portrayed them, they weren't misguided. You know, I thought that Jim had, he ended up having good ideas, and he ended up like, they were a good pair working together for a while until they lost their way, I thought. So it was more grounded. It was more human than I guess I anticipated going in. And again, it goes back to just what I remember about Jim and Tammy Faye. You know, I just remember seeing them on the pages of the front page of the Inquirer, you know, and the way that she was portrayed by the media, which I think becomes an interesting commentary towards the end of your film, where you talk about that and how, you know, she almost tries to rebel against it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Michael, just a quick thing, because it is 2021. It's 20 years since Wet Hot American Summer. And I just wanted to know, like, reflections back on that project and kind of like what you learned from that project that you could even utilize here making a film like this.
Hmm. Oh, man. I mean, I didn't direct Wet Hot.
Right.
And so much of. I mean, it was the first movie that I'd ever made. And so I think I got to have the experience of seeing the filmmaking process from the beginning to the end and kind of knowing what that is, what all goes into that. And it's obviously, you know, you talk about going back to this idea of a spoof and da da da. It's like that movie really is a spoof and sort of like, even though there's some kind of sincere heartfelt moments there, there's always that sense that we know we're making a movie. We know this is a joke. So I think if you know, what's been interesting for me sort of in my career has been sort of learning how to take those quotation marks off the work and to not give in to that part of me that does want to kind of wink at the camera, even though there's always going to be a part of me that, I mean, I do like, one of the things that I do like about this is that there is like a show within a show quality to it. It's it's about making television. It's about the camera. This Tammy Faye is about the camera and is about, in a lot of ways, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker are performing even when they're not on stage, you know, even when they're alone in their bedroom, there's a sort of a performative nature to what they're doing, because I think they always felt in a sense like they were being watched. But every project I do, I take something from it and bring it into the next one. Whether it's something I'll do again or something I'll never repeat, you know, I'll never do that again, you know? But that one for me was probably just about seeing the process of making a movie from beginning to end.
Yeah.
I love that you talk about the fact that they were almost performing even when they were on their own, because there's a moment when she says, he criticizes her voice and she says, "I thought you liked the Betty Boop voice." And from that moment on, I almost expected her to stop using it.
Right.
I almost saw this. She was putting it on the entire time. So that's pretty fascinating to hear you say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they have that quality. And I've known people like this who sort of like, it's like they're always on, they're always performing even when there's no one there
right.
to watch.
Right. One of the conversations that's going to come out of this film, obviously, is Jessica's performance. And so, you know, even just to maybe illustrate how far she even went for you, was an extremely drastic from table read to when she finally, you know, fully realized what her Tammy Faye was going to be?
The first time that I sort of heard her doing the voice and the character. I mean, she would sort of try it out on me in little bits and pieces. You know, I think she says this. So like we talked so much. She was very involved as a producer, not in addition to being the lead of the movie. So we were talking constantly about every aspect of the movie. And she would sort of throw out sample little, "Hey, I think she does this." The first time I really heard the character was when we recorded the music. So we recorded songs for the sound for the movie in June. I think we didn't shoot the movie until, I don't think we started shooting the movie until early November.
Oh, wow.
And so we actually, if memory serves, we recorded those songs in June. Mm-hmm. And so I heard her singing in the voice of the character. And so then starting in September and October, we started working with the prosthetics and trying to fine tune the prosthetics to find a version of the, of that look that would, that felt like the character. And I think it was in that process that we really started to, I really started to see it sort of taking shape. Mm. And then there were, and getting the gestures, like, you know, it was really fascinating to watch it slowly come together, like seeing her in the mirror with the makeup on and kind of trying out little gestures and stuff. And it's this, it's a very slow process, and you sort of add in little, she, you could sort of see her adding it in, building it piece by piece, mm-hmm. from starting with wanting to make sure that she looked like Tammy Faye Baker. That was so important. And then, getting the costume the right way, getting the makeup the right way, the nails, every little piece had to be right.
The nervous laughter too. I love the nervous laughter. Such a brilliant choice.
Yeah. I mean, I could go on forever about that. I mean, there were little things like, you know, the way she would like hunch her shoulder, she would eat something. And then like she would eat, you know, she eats the Oreos. I don't know if you remember, she's in bed. She's watching Jim on the 700 Club and she's eating Oreos and she like eats the Oreos. And then she sort of punches her shoulders. Like she loves the taste of food and she sort of like punches her shoulder. I mean, she really was in that character's body. It's pretty incredible.
One of the things I find interesting about this, though, is you mentioned the makeup and the prosthetics, is sometimes a performance can be put down by so much prosthetics and makeup. But in this case, the emotion is coming through it. And I think that's a really key thing to point out here, because it's easy to get lost in the prosthetics and let them do the work for you. So I was curious from you as a director, what conversations you have with Jessica and Andrew to make sure that the performance still came through, especially Jessica, because she's under so much prosthetics and makeup. What conversations do you have to make sure the emotion is coming through and not being oversaturated by the prosthetics?
Yeah, that was something that we were very conscious of, not wanting to bury her inside the prosthetics to where you lose Jessica. You still want to feel like you're watching Jessica Chastain, and that you can't see her underneath all of the, you know, the prosthetic. And so it was something that we were very conscious of, wanting to make sure that she wasn't just putting a big giant, like, you know, Freddy Krueger mask or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And what we ended up doing was taking some of it away. So the final prosthetic is sort of like, you know, there were some pieces that came off so that we could see more of her. And so the sort of the final choice of the prosthetic, which grows from when she's 19 years old until she's in her 60s, you know, was a combination of pieces and not the whole enchilada. Mm-hmm. And that was so that we were always sort of, it's like an optical illusion. It's like, it's Jessica Chastain, but it's also Tammy Faye Baker. And you kind of can't tell which one you're really looking at until the end of the movie. I think you just feel like you're looking at Tammy Faye Baker. You just sort of forget at that point that it's Jessica.
Well, the final scene, which I won't reveal, is brilliant. It's really fantastic. It's a perfect way to send off the character. We're going to run out of time very quickly. I just want to get your opinion on this, Michael. Could something like this ever happen again, Jim and Tammy Faye?
Sure.
You think so?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. What do you mean? Which part of it?
The being able to build an empire on the backs of people who you're deceiving, I guess.
Oh, I mean, I feel like it happens all the time.
Yeah, I guess so. I wish we as a society learned a little bit better.
I mean, what you just said doesn't that ring a bell? Building an empire on the backs of people that are being deceived?
Yes. Yes, it does.
It feels unfortunately like we've learned nothing.
Yes, that's true. That's very true.
It's really depressing.
Yeah.
Depending on who you ask, you know,
it's realistic.
But I mean, no, we're depending on who you ask, it doesn't seem like we're moving forward as a society. Mm-hmm. It in some respects feels like we're moving backwards. So that's just depends on who you ask.
Sure. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Are you in Toronto? Are you up there?
I'm in Toronto. Yes.
Well, enjoy the festival, and I hope the film goes over huge.
Thank you, and give my regards to everyone in Charlotte. We had such a great time. Really enjoyed our time there.
Well, thank you for bringing a production through. We're tired of losing things to Georgia, so come on back.
Okay, I will.
Good.
Be up on that.
Thank you so much to Michael Showalter for coming by the show. The Eyes of Tammy Faye is going wide, I'm pretty sure, this Friday. Yes, Kev.
Yeah, Sean, I was just wondering what you thought the tone of that interview was.
Oh, God. Remind me not to ask that question anymore. All right, yeah. You guys are on the other side of it, so I don't think we even talked about this. Was that a bad question?
No, it was actually a great question. And Gabe and I were, I think we were discussing this afterwards. It was cool to see, like, the interviewee turn the tables and talk to us, which is, like, you know, a really cool thing, because Sean asked a question in the interview, basically, which you just heard, which is, like, you know, the tone of this film, because and Sean was 100% right. There's a way that this movie could have been done where it could have been making fun of or been a spoof. And, like, one thing I really enjoyed, and we'll get to this in the review, is that there's a genuine heart to Tammy Faye's character in this film, and that mm-hmm. the human being behind the perception. So we'll dive into that. But I thought Sean's question was your question was great. I just love that he flipped the script a little bit. I think he was genuinely just curious, because the people had just started seeing the movie and he was probably just wondering how tonally it worked, because you're 100% right. It could have easily been the other way around.
Very true.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, well, we'll talk about Tammy Faye when we get later on into the show. Let's get to this week's talking points, and we're going to start with our boy. Our boy, Chris Nolan. Chris, as we like to call him, is shopping around a new film that's going to be about Oppenheimer and the A-bomb. It's a World War II film, from everything we're
understanding. Which was mentioned in Tenet, by the way. Oppenheimer was mentioned in Tenet.
Like, is he mentioned early on when he's describing,
They refer to Oppenheimer in comparison to what the person creates in the future that's going to end the world in Tenet. When I read that he was doing an Oppenheimer film, I was like, well, this must have been boiling in his mind for a while, because that name is specifically mentioned in Tenet, which is a...
And I also read that Pattinson gave him a book about Oppenheimer at the Tenet rap party.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, so we might have Pattinson to thank for
and
this.
And then they're saying that Cillian Murphy is possibly dancing around the film. And
I'd
like,
be cool with that.
And I saw some photos, some side-by-side of what Oppenheimer looked like and Cillian, and I feel like that could be a really good casting choice, to be honest. Like, I don't know if that's true, but, I mean, obviously, Nolan worked with Cillian on how many of his movies? Batman Begins, them, Dark Knight,
almost
Inception.
All,
Tenet.
Or
like
Michael
Dunkirk.
I see it.
Not Tenet.
I kind of see it.
Yeah, you see it, right? I saw someone do a side-by-side, so... I mean, I remember. I'll never forget Cillian in Dunkirk. He didn't even have a character name. It was like Shivering Man or something. I could totally see Cillian playing that.
Like in the eyes.
We'll see. I don't know if that's true. I just read that somewhere.
But the point of the story is that Mr. Nolan no longer is at Warner Brothers, where he had been doing the bulk of his film. Not all of them. No, he started at Paramount. Isn't that right?
Well, I know. So Memento was like Paramount Vantage.
It's everything
I believe.
Since. Insomnia, I think.
Right.
And really?
And there's a little asterisk on that, even though that is 100% accurate, because Interstellar did open up with Paramount domestically, but it was Warner Brothers International. So he still made the film technically with Warner Brothers, but Paramount released it, distributed it domestically. So I think Insomnia is, because Insomnia came right after Memento, right, Gabe? So it was everything of Insomnia, forward. So
the point being, he's had a relationship with the studio for a really long time, and the events of Tenet, I'm going to have to assume, came between them. Essentially, you know, the way that Warner Brothers handled Tenet, and, you know, to be fair, and to play both sides, had their backs against a very difficult wall in terms of how
What is it that they did with Tenet? Was it Tenet, or was it the HBO day and date for the other filmmakers?
It's twofold. I mean,
what
again,
did they do? They busted their ass to get Tenet out in theaters.
Well, it was getting pushed back the way several other films were getting pushed back, and maybe I think they would have. I'm putting words in their mouth. I think they would have preferred to hold it the way that a lot of other films have since held it. And sure. I think Nolan wanted to come out essentially. And I think they hit an impasse over that.
The way the Hollywood Reporter article talks about, which is what we're going to get into here with the demands, the quote unquote demands that Nolan had made in terms of finding a new studio. It sounded like to me, and again, this is all speculation, that the HBO Max thing was like the deal breaker. Like, remember his comments were pretty brutal about HBO Max. He called it like the worst streaming service. Yes. And this was all about the day and date in terms of films coming out and releasing at the same date in theaters and HBO Max. I think the Tenet release structure and kind of how that all went down, that obviously started the ripple, I would argue, just based on what I've read. And then the HBO Max thing, I think, was a big deal breaker. That's what I gather from the overall scope of it. But again, we're reading this based on people's reports. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's interesting that because Universal doesn't have a streaming service, right?
Peacock.
Oh, I guess Peacock.
So, like,
Peacock.
For example, like, I think Boss Baby 2 may have come out in theaters and Peacock at the same time. Am I right on that?
Halloween Kills is about to.
Halloween Kills is doing a day and date?
On Peacock.
No, they're not.
On Peacock.
Oh,
yes,
I did not know that.
Yes, they are.
Oh, that's bad. Why?
I saw a headline that was like Halloween Kills .. theaters ?
Oh, why are they doing that? Why would they just give that the 17-day treatment? Just go 17 days exclusively in theaters, then go to Peacock.
Well, because no one's heard of Peacock.
They're pushing Peacock.
Start hearing of Peacock.
Well, it's and to Gabe's point, we did a story on our morning show today about they're doing the whole Fresh Prince of Bel-Air revival. Yeah.
It's a drama, right?
Yeah. And they're just like, and they're just coming up with crazy stuff in order to get people to sign up for the streaming service. But Sean, you can go ahead and read Nolan's terms because I don't think this will affect Nolan's movies at all.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you guys these. I want to go one at a time through these. This is via the Hollywood Reporter, who is talking about Christopher Nolan going over to Universal Studios, and these are what he has to hold on to in order to make a deal with a studio.
There's one I think is a little ridiculous, and I'll let you get.
All right, so let's go one at a time. Total creative control. It's fine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's earned that.
I would argue that every filmmaker should have.
Also, and while you're reading this, total creative control basically means final cut, essentially, right? And like in terms of like casting
That leads into, like, he even gets final cut on trailers and like the way that it's pitched to audiences.
Would be fun?
Like,
this would be a fun conversation outside of this. Like, which directors do we think still hold quote unquote?
That sounds like a bonus episode.
Total creative control. Because like we were talking about, Paul Thomas Anderson has a movie coming out, you know, in December.
The title is the best.
Do you know what it is?
It's like Licorice. I read it yesterday because they're actually playing a 35mm film print of the trailer exclusively in theaters right now. It's not online yet. It's called Licorice. I'll look it up. Hold on.
Because the joke was in Las Vegas when we were there for CinemaCon.
Licorice Pizza. That's the name of his new movie. Licorice Pizza. Isn't that the best title ever? It's really such a good title.
The studio executive came out and he was like...
Does that make him Licorice Pizza as opposed to Jon Favreau's cheese pizza?
There you go. But I mean, I guess I'll just use this real fast. There is a theater, if you look it up online, that is playing an exclusive 35mm print of just that. This is the Bradley Cooper movie that he made just recently. And they're playing a trailer on film. It's a Nolan move. It sounds like a Nolan move to me. Like, he's playing it only in theaters. It's cool.
All right. Total.
You know, Nolan
control.
Didn't actually invent celluloid, right?
But Nolan. Nolan does release trailers exclusively in theaters before they go online, which is cool.
He did for Dunkirk, didn't he?
And Tenet.
Tenet too.
Yeah.
Yes, Tenet. All right. At least a 100-day theatrical window.
Perfect.
That's the one where I go like
100 days.
No problem.
Well, just because. But the issue, Kevin, for me is that like most movies just don't make money for that long. Like it's
true. And you know, who's to say that they're not sticking you on theater 17, you know, that's a postage stamp size.
I just feel like by the end of that agreement they're like fudging it to make it work.
But wouldn't his argument be the Avengers movies do? Like movies can make money for that long.
Yeah.
Sure.
This is a bit on the lower side for him in terms of budget. I think this is a reportedly $100 million, which is what Dunkirk was cost to make as well.
Here's the next, and maybe this isn't as far fetched as I think, but the next one says around $100 million budget,
mm-hmm.
and around $100 million marketing spend.
Yeah.
Do you think they match?
Usually they spend. When you see a production budget, it's usually double is what the budget for the movie is because they use the same for marketing. And there are some instances where now they use even more. It's kind of like why people say these days marketing teams are really the creative forces behind films because they spend the most money and so they have the most power and say. And
think about
it. Double is usually, I think is normal.
And Nolan's marketing is always brilliant. Like, I mean, if you guys remember the first trailer for Tenet, for Dunkirk, it was like, I think it was 60 seconds and it just ended on that shot of all the soldiers looking up.
That was great.
And that was like a year before the movie came out. And the anticipation that I still find it so incredible. And this is why these terms make sense to me, that he opened a World War II film that wasn't even based in an American part of the story in summer and crushed at the box office domestically and worldwide. Yeah. I mean, you had American audiences going to a British World War II story about World War II, and it made a lot of money because Nolan's name was on it. That's why he deserves these terms.
Well, here's the last few. 20% of the first dollar gross. Fine. I mean, it's Nolan.
A lot of money.
a blackout period where the studio would not release another movie for 3 weeks before or 3 weeks after the feature.
I'm shocked that
that's what studio, he's like saying, hey, this is a smarter idea, you know?
That's smart business news for the studio. Why would the studio compete with itself?
Well, it's smart. Well, I guess I saw someone tweet something about this, like, what if Universal wants to put out Despicable Me 4 2 weeks before Nolan's
movie?
They're
not going to the same audience.
But they can't do that, according to this. So the studio basically has a six-week window where they can't... Because Universal puts out a lot of movies. I mean, and Warner Brothers probably couldn't adhere to this, I would imagine, because they have basically a movie every 2 weeks or something like that. I don't know if he had this same deal at Warner Brothers. Some of this might have been the same. But a six-week window surrounding your film, to me is like, you've earned some status as a director if you can ask for something like that, especially on a studio like Universal, because again, like Despicable Me 4 is a different audience. I saw someone use this as an example, and the fact that he would have that 6 week area covered, it's pretty insane. He's earned it. Like I said, with
I
Dunkirk.
Want to see them put the Nolan Oppenheimer trailer in front of Despicable 4.
All right, so I did just look up because I was curious, because I think Dunkirk and Oppenheimer could be a pretty comparable, because I don't think either so Dunkirk hit theaters on July 21st of its year, and it did very well opening weekend. Just that first day, it made $20 million. Its last day in theaters, before they pulled it, where it made $803, was November 23rd.
Yeah.
So that's almost 5 months. Right? July?
Yeah.
Right? That's 5 months. So 100 days isn't that crazy, I guess. He got more than that without asking for it.
Well, and it was an awards movie. Like, his movies are awards movies. Generally. So they get a longer run because they're trying to... Those audiences that sort of, I would imagine, are going to continue to build as hype builds around nominations.
But also, he's earned this. I mean, this is a filmmaker who is the star of his movies. Like, I would argue that Nolan can open movies better than Spielberg can now. And I'm not saying that Nolan's a better filmmaker than Spielberg. I'm just saying that the Nolan name is so synonymous with box office success. Dunkirk, to me, is the greatest example of that. And I've already said why. But that's a pretty big deal to be able to do that in the middle of a summer, to open a film like that and make that much money. And like Jake just said, it was making money throughout. I mean, I saw Dunkirk 6 times and not in 70mm IMAX.
Made money through you.
I spent so much money on Dunkirk and Interstellar. But
that 100 days is because he knows how many times you'll go see it. 100 times.
See it. But
he did it for you, Kevin.
Yeah. But I mean, this isn't that crazy. And I'm glad Jake brought up that example, because 100 days, and especially Dunkirk, and Gabe had a good point. Dunkirk was an awards film. That was like probably because that was his first Best Director nomination.
I believe so, because he didn't get one for Dark Knight.
Or Interstellar. I think he got...
Wait, did he get one for Inception?
I don't think he got... I think Inception got a picture nomination, but not... And then Wally...
How do you not give him a director nomination?
Wally won for cinematographer that year. I remember that.
I do think that there's... For better or worse, people kind of give a lot of flack, and, you know, we talk about Twitter as Twitter, and people are going to say what they're going to say about whatever. But the discussion around what was going on with Tenet was about how he was being vocal because he was accepting the responsibility as a big name filmmaker to try to set a standard for the industry.
Help
and I
save
think
theaters.
That it's no accident. Yeah. I think that it's no accident that these terms are very public and very much being covered and talked about.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would imagine that this is the same sort of move where I'm not trying to, you know, build him up any more than he is, but I think that the fact that we have a bulleted list of what he wanted, this is less of get to my level and you can get this, and this is more like a, if we can do this model and this works, then this proves that theaters can sustain a 100-day window, that theaters can sustain a big budget and can sustain this sort of model. He's obviously an exceptional filmmaker.
Yeah.
But I think that there's more strategy to it of trying to build a very theater-focused idea around his films in order to influence the industry as a whole. I think that's a large part of why we know so much about this.
Did you read the article? Did you guys read the full article?
Yeah.
About how about how he had studios come to where he lived, basically. It's a really incredible thing that he...
You think Apple even had a chance?
I was wondering, apparently Apple was in the running, and I don't understand how, because...
I was going to say, I am kind of, with all due respect to the streamers, I'm happy he landed at a traditional studio.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure he wanted to. But Apple has, like... literally trillions of dollars in cash. They could have given him $1 billion and just said, here, make a movie.
Don't you want to see Nolan in that montage of people going to Doom for Netflix? For the To Doom fan. But I'd like to welcome you all to To Doom.
But Gabe makes a really good point about the public nature of this article, because I was wondering why we knew all this information, and it makes perfect sense, because it basically just, again, it goes to what because to me with Tenet, and if you look at Tenet, and this is something we discuss a lot on the show, I would argue that what he was doing was trying to save theaters. And I know that people were like, you know, it was, you know, Nolan doesn't care about this and that. He was just trying to keep the theaters going. He was trying to keep the employees employed. He was trying to keep the movies going, even though we were in a tough time. And I think he just, that was his mindset. And in terms of the terms, the article, basically his scripts are always super secretive. So from what the article basically says is that the heads of these studios, including Tom Rothman from Sony, apparently was a big one that was involved in the negotiations here as well. They all had to go out to the Hollywood Hills, read the script for his Oppenheimer film, and then essentially go through these terms. But it sounds like from the article that he had a relationship already with the head of Universal, that he was already kind of working with her, I believe, about that. So I think her name is Donna. I don't want to misspeak on that, but that's what the article was saying. So
I pitched him on releasing it on my YouTube channel, but
I mean, you have the silver.
You know, I went out to the Hollywood Hills. I read the script and I said, I can offer you literally thousands of views.
Yeah. And literally. you said no, because he wanted 20% of the YouTube.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And he wanted to keep it on my channel for 100 days. And I was like, I can't promise you that.
Yeah. He said, no, you don't post anything a few weeks before.
Yeah. No videos for 6 weeks.
I was like, I can't do that. Let's get to someone else who has total creative control, or for God's sakes, should. Mr. Steven Spielberg, who just decided on a Wednesday he was going to come out and decimate the competition by dropping a West Side Story trailer that looks unbelievable. And so I've come from not I was never at a point where I was like, I don't necessarily care for this movie, but I was like, it's Spielberg doing West Side Story. That's unusual because he loves the original so much. And is he going to be too lost in the weeds? To now, holy shit, give it all the Oscars. It looks absolutely incredible. And I really, really hope it plays as well as the trailer does, because it looks like Janusz is shooting the daylights out of this. Compositions look fantastic. The cast looks perfect. Someone who, Kimberly, who listens to us on a regular, did bring up the point of Ansel Elgort only having one line of dialogue in the trailer. But I don't know. Is it? I mean, it is his movie a bit. But I kind of see it being as more as Maria's movie.
I would say when I think of West Side Story, I think of Maria.
Yeah.
And in fact, whenever I tell someone hey, Spielberg's making West Side Story. The question I always get is, who's playing Maria?
Yeah.
Do you think the Ansel Elgort thing is because of the potential controversy surrounding him?
I don't know. I didn't think of that. But again, Kimberly sort of tweeted, who listens to us, she sort of tweeted, oh, it's unusual that he only has one. And I've heard other people say, like, ooh, the campaign for that's going to be complicated because of his issues. I'm not as familiar with his issues. I don't know the story quite as well, but there have been people who have said to me immediately, like, oh, Ansel Elgort's going to be a problem. So
yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm in the same boat as you. I remember reading about he had some controversy, and that was like, every time the movie comes up again, it's like it gets reignited somehow. But aside from the controversy, in terms of the film itself and the trailer, nobody shoots and lights films like Kominsky. Like, there is something so specifically special about the way shots look in a Spielberg film, specifically with Kominsky as the DP. I mean, there is just, it's almost like dreamlike in the best film quality you could ever imagine. And we all know Spielberg shoots on film, and Kominsky obviously does in this as well. And there's just something special about it. The moment the trailer hit, I was immersed in the world. There's just something really special about there's it's magical. And I don't really know how to explain it, because everyone, you ask the question sometimes to a filmmaker, why do you shoot on film? Why do you shoot digitally? And the word that, like, I remember Abrams at Force Awakens said the word magical. And a lot of filmmakers have said magical every time I bring up film. And that's how I feel watching a Spielberg movie. There's something specifically special and magical about every single inch of his frame. And you just know that it's a master. I mean, we all agree he's the best filmmaker of all time. Like, he just has to be.
Two of us. Yeah. Two of us agree.
Aronofsky is like
right here.
I mean, right, I love Aronofsky. Fine. But I mean, but the trailer, I'm with you, Sean. The trailer, this trailer is what floored me. I think, I mean, I'm telling you right now, there's only a few filmmakers that, like, make the hair on my arm stand up when I see their name come up in a trailer. Like, a Steven Spielberg film, or a Christopher Nolan film, or a Quentin Tarantino film, Scorsese. I mean, there's only a handful, I would argue, for me. And just seeing that name still makes me excited.
It's not even that. It was like right from the get-go, you're right, that first shot of the side of the tenement and the way that she's lit on the balcony. Oh. But then the minute it comes in on her close-up and she starts to sing, I got goosebumps.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't even necessarily love the West Side Story songs.
It's the composition of the shot. It's the lighting. Yeah. There's a magic to it. You feel like he's captured lightning in a bottle. Like, there's
every time.
I don't know how to explain.
Keep in mind, he's been like wanting to make this movie for 30 years. And whenever I watch that trailer, I go, oh, you've been thinking about this for 30 years. You've been playing, this isn't just something you wanted to do for 30 years and then got it and went, oh shit, how do I do this? You've been planning out how you're, like, I guarantee you there were some shots we saw in that trailer that have been in his head for 30 years that he's been thinking. Sean, you pointed out a shot. When the first teaser came out and the shadows crossed each other.
Still a brilliant
but
shot.
But Sean, you pointed out, and I'm going to do such a piss poor job of trying to explain it, but near the end, when you see the two of them and there are people moving in front of them.
Yeah.
It's just,
because he frames Ansel left. As the people are going past, and right as your eye sort of adjusts to where he is in the frame, it goes immediately to Maria, and she's on the right, she's got the crowd going in the opposite direction, and it says so much beautifully in just the composition, let alone how fantastic the gym looks, and all of it looks amazing.
So I showed the trailer to someone today at my station who is a diehard West Side Story fan. In fact, she's Puerto Rican, so West Side Story meant a lot to her growing up, one of our lead anchors. And I think she watched the trailer like with skepticism, thinking like, okay, why are they making this movie? Mm-hmm. And even when she got done watching the trailer, she was kind of like, damn, like, okay. Like, what are you going to do? How can you watch that trailer? And granted, like, we haven't seen the movie yet. We don't know how the movie's going to turn out.
Sure.
But how do you watch that trailer and at least go, I don't want to see it.
Quick question. So I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it two or three films out of all of Spielberg's filmography that he's not worked with John Williams, right? I think it's Ready Player One.
Yeah.
And there was a few of them. I was looking at the credits for this. I know Leonard Bernstein did the music, obviously, for the movie. But I don't see Williams's name on this. Does that mean
I don't think Williams worked on it?
Right. So I was going to ask: is there? Because according to the credits, the composer is Bernstein. So does that mean like all the music is just kind of like is West Side Story music, and there's not going to be like a main like a score that's been written for the film, or is did Bernstein do the score? I mean, I'm trying to figure all that out.
I think he's going to have to rely on the original music. So I don't think there's been anything original.
Because Bernstein died in 1990. So but he according to this, he has the music by credit.
Are you looking? Are you looking on IMDb?
Let me look.
Or where were you looking? Sorry,
that was Wikipedia. Hold on.
Yeah, it might just be that all the information on it is not out yet. That happens a lot before.
But do you think there's a composer? Do you think there's a composer in the movie aside from Bernstein's music?
I would imagine someone had to help arrange things. Like, I'm sure everything was re-recorded. They may have used the original written music. Because
it's not
going
to flow on film the way it flows on stage.
Right, so, IMDb, normally where the composer's name is, it says music by Leonard Bernstein and the original music by. I mean, we obviously know he wrote the music, but he died in 1990. So I wonder if there's a
I just think
composer.
That I think that information might be in... It's too early. That information might just be incomplete.
Do you think Williams would come in and do it? Or do you think he's going to bring in, like... Someone to like.
If it was Williams, I bet we would know, right?
Yeah,
now.
I would say if it were Williams, it would be on there already.
Because I mean, he
in the same way that whenever they announced, you know, on Mangold's Indy 5, when they announced certain people were coming back, around the time they announced freaking Harrison Ford was coming back, John Williams' name was up there. Yeah. Like, oh, also John Williams is coming back.
They're going to get somebody very dependable, like James Horner, and he'll knock it out of the park, and he'll play the West Side Story music essentially.
Yeah.
But maybe with like a new flair on it. So.
Yeah. I thought James Horner had passed.
Oh, has he?
Passed. Yeah. He passed in 2015.
Then it won't be him.
Yeah. So
I'm just glad you pronounced his name right.
Horner's amazing.
The only thing I got right.
But I am curious if anybody listening knows. Would love to know if
he went by Jim actually.
If there's going to be a composer, I would love to know. Yeah. Like if there's going to be someone who's like putting it all together kind of thing, or it might just be Bernstein's music. It might just be his music the entire time.
Yeah,
Steve, if you're listening, reach out to Gabe. He's at a...
Yeah, we can set something up. We have a strict schedule, but we can maybe...
Yeah. I do kind of want to know, though. I do want to know, because he rarely works without Williams. Very rarely.
If we get Spielberg, we're going to promise no interviews 3 weeks before. And no
and
interviews
after.
3 weeks
well,
after.
Just... None after.
And we're going to run the interview.
That's where we'll stop.
The interview
that's
will run we'll for stop. 100 episodes straight.
That is our natural conclusion.
What is the terminology in video games? He's the big boss.
He's the final boss.
He's the final boss.
He's the final boss. All right, this week in movies. I did not get a chance to see Cop Shop. Who got a chance to see Cop Shop? Jake Hamilton, take it away.
Yeah. Kevin, I don't know about you. I really like the plot of this movie.
It's over the top, Western-like.
Yes, but that's a great way of putting it. Basically, like an assassin is being paid a ton of money to knock out this guy, to kill this guy. Gerard Butler is the assassin. Frank Grillo is the guy he's trying to kill. Frank Grillo does something very smart, which is purposefully get himself arrested to protect himself from this killer. Well, then the killer basically says, cool, I can do that too. So he gets himself arrested.
Butler's character.
And then they end up, so basically at the end of the first act, they end up in cells opposite of each other.
That's clever.
And then that's when shit gets crazy. It's a very clever premise. It's Joe Carnahan, who I actually think is a very underrated director. Kevin, I think you're with me on this. The Gray is a masterpiece. Stone Cold masterpiece. The Gray is a masterpiece.
The Gray is one of the greatest movies to come out in a long time. Like genuinely,
I love the Gray.
It's so
Wait, Gabe,
good.
You lit up, or do you love The Gray too?
No, I made a Gray.
I
made a Gray
laughing,
pun.
Yeah, I was laughing at his Gray.
My Gray. Look,
I thought this was very fun, but
Joe Carnahan,
I would put this.
He's also directed some. He directed The A-Team. You know, like let's.
Did
I know
Carnahan
we made
do Narc?
I like The A-Team.
Did Carnahan do Narc?
He might have. He did.
Narc was really
he
good.
He did Smoking Aces.
Smoking Aces is the one I was thinking of.
Yeah,
I thought he did Narc.
But here's what I'll say. I enjoyed this film. I do like think it like now that we're in an age of like movies come out on VOD versus theaters. I think this would be a super fun, enjoyable like watch at home and kick back and enjoy it with like a whiskey and some popcorn or something at home. I'm not sure in the weeks that we have coming out that it's a, hey, get in your car and drive to the theater and go see it kind of movie. Kevin, what do you think?
I'm going to use this opportunity because I agree with you. to recommend another great Gerard Butler movie that came out last year called Greenland, because I think Butler's like just quietly putting out like some cool ass flicks. I love Olympus Has Fallen. I thought Angel Has Fallen was solid. London Has Fallen was terrible. But he's doing some, like, he just kind of like hits these like random films, and some of them hit, some of them don't. Mm-hmm. And I like the ones that hit. Like Jake's 100% right. Cop Shop has a lot of fun qualities to it. It's super violent too. It's like, it's really crazy. So,
all right. Well, that's out there for you guys to check out. So is Clint Eastwood's Cry Macho. And I think I'm the only one who's seen Cry Macho. Is that correct?
We have not seen it. Yeah.
Cry Macho, and it breaks my heart to say this, is a unique kind of awful. It's we talk about Clint, how he'll have like a hit and then like five duds, and you're like, what happened to him? And then he'll come back with a one that just sort of knocks you out. This is not one of those. This is spectacularly bad. And it's by a filmmaker who, and we were having a conversation about this before we got on, has just gotten kind of lazy. Like it cuts every corner possible. The script makes little sense at all. Clint Eastwood, it's made by a man who clearly thinks that all of the parts of his legacy still exist. He has two love interests in this movie. He's 91 years old. Like, they're about 30.
Like in The Mule, where he gives himself two three-ways.
So it worked in the... He goes, I got away with it in The Mule. I'm going to put it into this one as well, too.
Did it work in The Mule?
And he'll keep doing it? No!
Did it work?
No.
Was that second three-way justified, Sean?
No, it wasn't. He also, this is the story of, he gets hired to go down into Mexico, to find the boy of a guy he works for and bring him back home, essentially. That's the root of the story. And the reason is given is because Clint is an old kind of cowboy, and the boy would love to meet a cowboy and follow him home. And Dwight Yoakam actually says, like, isn't that every boy's dream? And I was like, no, it's not. I don't imagine to hang out
but
with
also
a cowboy.
Keep in mind,
and
then isn't this based on a book written in the 70s?
I think it is. Yeah. And it is set in the 70s. But still, I'm going to argue that this kid didn't want to hang out with Clint for the better part of 2 months as they try to get back to Texas. It's just sad. It wanders. It has no real focus or direction at all. Clint scares me, and even if this is part of the performance, he looks so frail. It's one of these movies where they're constantly getting pursued by the henchmen of the people who he's trying to outrun, and Clint has like three fight scenes. And he moves so slowly, and then they'll have like an obvious cut, like fist, and then the young bad guy he's fighting falls down, clutching his face.
Is the character also 91? Like, is the character meant to be old? Like,
he's Eastwood. Yes, maybe not that old, but he in the opening scene he gets fired from the ranch that he's working on, and the guy's like, "Why haven't you retired already? Like, why are you still holding on?" So yes, he's kind of playing with
that idea. Okay.
For sure, but maybe too much. It is not. And it made me sad because, and I tweeted this, like, I hope this isn't his last movie. He's getting to the age where it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, one day we found out that Mr. Eastwood just wasn't with us anymore. And I would hate
Less morbid.
Morbid.
He stopped making movies.
See, that's the thing. I don't think he will. I think he's literally going to keep going.
I kind of love that he just wants to keep going. And like at the end of the day, I'm not saying that. And we've had this discussion on the show before. I mean, he's a good filmmaker. I don't think he's a great filmmaker, but he's obviously a great actor.
Yeah. I think it's too easy for him to ever stop.
Yeah, and yes. I think
someone's always going to bankroll him. It's not like he's spending a ton of money.
But he loves it.
He shoots them and
he loves it.
5 hours a day.
He just loves it. I mean, how many decades has he been on a movie set? Think about how many.
Just a movie set, a set period.
Decades. Yeah. So I would argue that him going to a movie set's probably his happy place. Like, terms of, like,
has
what...
Has it been three quarters of a century that he's been on movie
sets? Yeah. I mean, what year was... For a few dollars more and Good, Bad, and the Ugly and all those movies were the 60s, right? What was Good, Bad, and the Ugly?
When was Gunsmoke?
Gunsmoke and all that. Like,
was doing Gunsmoke, yeah.
Black and white television Clint was doing.
Have you ever heard Tom Hanks's story about Clint Eastwood?
No, but I'd like to.
This guy.
So I'm gonna tell this very quickly, Gabe. I'm so sorry.
I'm just kidding.
So Tom Hanks tells a great story about Clint Eastwood, because Clint Eastwood comes from the days where, like, obviously they were like on horses shooting westerns and stuff, and he used to hate whenever the directors would shout action, because it would scare the horses and it'd kind of like throw off the beginning of the take. So Clint Eastwood used to go over to the directors and be like, hey, can you be like chill and just like let us know when it's time and we'll go. You're scaring the freaking horses. And he said that he still does that to this day. He goes, you'll be on set. Tom Hanks shot obviously Sully with Clint Eastwood. And he said, you know, you'll be normally it's like, all right, we're rolling. Action, act, let's go, action. And he goes, Clint Eastwood basically just walks up to you and goes, okay, go ahead. And then he goes, and then like when the take's done, he just goes, all right, that's enough. Like that's the Clint Eastwood, which like I picture that entire. That is exactly what I picture when I think of like Clint Eastwood directing.
Yeah, and you know what? It's the quintessential polar opposite of the Tarantino conversation we've had, where he's so adamant about his legacy that he needs to only do one more to make it
perfect.
That's
an interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting comparison.
And Clint's literally just like,
I just want to do it.
Yeah.
He's been his first credit was in 1955, so he's been on sets for 66 years.
Yeah,
amazing.
Let the dude make what he wants to make.
And that's what I say.
And from Tarantino's perspective, I understand, I understand where he's coming from, because he's one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, and I think that he has a certain level.
Well, even before he's a filmmaker, even though he's one of the greatest of all time, he's a film fanatic first. That's the bit of him only doing 10, it's not about that everyone should do 10. It's that he wants to be the guy that only did 10 and made 10 great movies. Like it's from the perspective of him as a film fan, not even of him as necessarily a filmmaker.
Yeah.
If you suggested that to Clint, he'd look at you and go, huh? What do you mean?
But don't you feel, guys, like, cause we can all say this now, having met him and having interviewed him. Whenever I think of people, and we've all interviewed a lot of people, it's special that we've sat across from him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's when you like that, he's one of those people that I think, like, damn, like I've sat across from him and had conversations about film and about his life. Like, when you think about like his place in, like, he's one of the last of that generation.
Yes.
Maybe in terms of like that era of film. Like,
and
he's
it was
one of
fun.
Our last
I actually heard.
He also loves peanuts too. He's a big fan of peanuts.
Yeah, I love that. If you've never seen Kevin's interview with him
for Sully,
is that correct?
Yeah.
But I love that he's giving you gold. He's giving you great answers as a filmmaker. He just is munching on peanuts while he does
Speaking of Tom Hanks, that was Tom Hanks's room. That was Tom Hanks's junket room, and Hanks was like hadn't showed up yet, so they threw Eastwood into the room to do two quick interviews, mine and a buddy of mine's, and he just ate peanuts the whole interview, and it was awesome. I had felt zero. I thought it was the coolest thing ever that he was noshing on peanuts.
He's the best. All right, Blue Bayou. I was not able to see Blue Bayou yet. You guys take it away. Kev, what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, so we're actually going to have Justin on our show, if it happens. He's a really super talented filmmaker. I'm excited to talk to him because he shot this on 16mm. It's also shot on a very unique aspect ratio, which is 1:66:1, which is kind of what Robin Wright used actually for Land. We had Robin Wright on. If you missed that interview, you can find it on our Real Blend podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. But yeah, I mean, this is a story.
Kevin's a real company man today.
Alicia Vikander is the star. And Justin's character, I mean, Jake, you've seen it. His character was legally adopted into the United States over 30 years ago. He has a run-in with law enforcement and is now facing deportation. And the fact that could even happen is insane. And that's kind of what the story is talking about. And Alicia Vikander plays his wife in the film. And, you know, she's one of the best actresses working today. I mean, her accent is unbelievably great in this film. I thought Justin was, I mean, we'll talk to him about it, but cinematography wise and filmmaking wise and score wise, this film hits on all levels. I do think it's a little slow at times. I don't know if Jake agrees, but the performances are really fantastic. The filmmaking is great. It honestly brought light to an issue that I didn't know a ton about, specifically what's happening to his character Antonio in this film. And to me, the beauty of filmmaking, and I think you guys could agree with me, is that when you can learn something about life through film, that then makes you aware of something, that makes you want to learn more about it, that maybe you could do something about it. And I think this specific case, or his character, had been in the United States for over 30 years and faces this deportation. I mean, Jake, I won't go into details, but this third act of this film is is gut-wrenching. Like, it's really, really hard to watch. And I thought that just performance-wise, he did a really good job with it. And I'm excited to have him on because it's really cool. And we'll talk about this in the interview. He shot on 16 mil, so it's like super gritty and grainy. But sometimes when you're shooting on film, you get hair in the gate. And if you look at film as it's processed, you'll see like pieces of like lint or hair that are, he kept those in the movie. So if you watch the film really closely, like there's specific shots where the hair in the gate, he kept it in.
You gotta ask him about that.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it's really and
what if it's just a time thing or a budget thing.
So it's just raw. It feels like it's like a raw, natural, almost like documentary style where they just shot what they shot and they got what they got, and that's what you're seeing. And like the whole concept of Blue Bayou, because the character I believe was raised near the Louisiana Bayou, right, Jake? I think that's the concept. So the accents are strong. It has some very, very intense cinematography. The character is trying to make money to try and pay for the legal fees to help his deportation, so he steals motorcycles. And then the way those scenes are shot are just really cinematic. It wasn't Justin in Twilight?
Which I did not remember him in those films, but whenever I looked him up on IMDb to get ahead of the junket, he's in all the Twilight films.
And I honestly didn't realize that he would. I mean, I don't remember him in Twilight either, but I don't really know much about him as a filmmaker until I saw this film, and I was really impressed just kind of visually what he did. There's a certain tone to this film, the way it's shot and the way it's done. The only reason I bring this up is because of the motorcycles. Do you guys remember The Place Beyond the Pines?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was like there was a great motorcycle opener in that film where Gosling rides out into like a circular pit and does this like awesome. And the way they did that was really cool, where it's Gosling for a second, even though it's a oner. And then they switch it off with a stunt guy with cool camera techniques. But the way the motorcycles were shot,
which is a shame, because Gosling really should have done it.
Yeah, yeah. But
commit to the bit.
The only reason why, and this is such a
get
random
your ass on a yeah, what are we talking about?
such a random thing to bring up. But the way the motorcycles were used in this film reminded me of the way it was used in Place Beyond the Pines, even though they're very different films.
I thought the same thing.
But there's like a feeling to the way. Who's the director of Place Beyond the Pines?
Derek Cianfrance.
Who also did Blue Valentine, right?
Yes. Like, but not Blue Bayou.
Right, Blue Bayou. But there's
maybe that's what it is. Maybe he saw Blue Valentine.
There's a rawness to the way Pines was done that reminded me of the way this was done in terms of just the immersive quality of the filmmaking. I was very impressed with it from a filmmaking standpoint.
We are going to be talking about The Eyes of Tammy Faye, I think, a lot through the awards season, because of Jessica Chastain. I think that she's a shoo-in for a nomination, playing Tammy Faye Baker. And she, in a way that a lot of other people haven't recently, disappears into a role. I did not see Jessica Chastain anymore. I don't know if you guys agree with that, with how
100%
immersed she got into
completely
it.
Completely gone.
But she disappears. So this story...
emotionally, and not just physically, by the way, which is important to say. It's like, she could have easily disappeared behind the makeup. I don't mean to cut you off, but what you said was really important, because easily this performance could have been driven by the makeup and the prosthetics. Yeah. But she comes through it all, which is to me the why she's amazing in the film.
She conveys a lot of the insecurities that plagued Tammy Faye, and part of the reason why she relied so heavily on Jim Baker, part of the reason why the two of them relied so heavily on religion. It was fascinating to do four episodes of Mike Flanagan's Midnight Mass, which takes a very different approach to religion, and then switch gears and watch The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
That's interesting.
You guys will understand that once you're able to see both, because the tones are wildly different. The only thing I'll say about the film is that I didn't leave that movie with a better understanding of why Jim and Tammy Faye Baker did all the things that they did. They essentially set up an entire organization network of Christian televangelism, and oddly enough, it happened right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then as they kept continuing to, I thought, authentically spread the word of God. I thought they believed that they were doing the right thing initially, but the more they made money from it, the way televangelists did at that time, this is the 80s and into the early 1990s, they got corrupt. Jim Baker primarily got corrupt. And I thought the movie did a pretty good job of just like showing you all the stuff that happened, yeah. but I don't think it
show
ever really
altering.
Got underneath.
Show altering. Yeah,
thank
sorry.
You very much. But I don't think it got below the surface too much into their characters, except for probably what Chastain was able to accomplish. Jakey, where are you at
yeah.
with it?
Yeah, it you know I was hoping for a little bit more out of the story for a, as you said, it kind of felt like someone else read the Wikipedia article about them and then tried to tell me what happened through it was their interpretation. So it just sort of felt like I kind of got the nuts and bolts. In fact, whenever I went back and read about them afterward, there were some pretty big things that I sort of went, oh, I'm surprised they did not put that in the movie. Like mm-hmm. there was some pretty, you know. Yeah, I think Chastain is phenomenal, and any praise she gets, I think, is entirely deserved. Garfield, I thought, is fine. You know, I almost kind of wonder who else maybe could have done more with that role, and in turn, because those are two performances that could make each other better, and it also makes me wonder how much better Chastain could have been if she had had a better counterpart. You know who I thought was phenomenal was Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah, he was really
as
good.
Jerry Falwell. Mm-hmm. He was incredible. I mean, he's great in all the supporting roles that he takes. Yeah, I thought it was perfectly fine. I thought the movie was fine. And as I often say, I feel like around this time of year, we start getting all the biopics, and I always say the same thing, which is the performance is better than the movie. That's for me, for 90% of biopics, that's the case. The performance is better than the movie, and that is entirely the case for me with this film.
I found it surprising how much heart I had specifically for Tammy Faye's character, because... And like in terms of, again, I'm coming from this from an outside perspective. I didn't know a ton about the story, but the perception of Tammy Faye just based on like her makeup and just like the way that she sounded. I wasn't sure, like, and going back to what Sean was saying earlier with Showalter, with how what tone they were going to be displaying here, and I just felt like the movie. Again, I didn't watch a lot of the footage from back in the day. The movie just showed how big of a heart Tammy Faye had. And to me, that's what I connected with the most was the vulnerability of Tammy Faye, of Jessica Chastain's character. I do think her performance is better than Garfield's. The problem with Garfield's performance is not his emotional aspect. It's the makeup. For him,
was he wearing a Spider-Man suit the whole time?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, and
in Sean's eyes, he was.
But I thought, and I don't know if you guys felt the same way about this. I thought when I watched the movie, I believed that Chastain was Tammy Faye. But as I watched Garfield, I kept thinking that's just Garfield in old makeup.
There was one scene in particular when he was turned to the side, and I pointed to Michelle and I said, look, you can see the makeup line.
Yeah.
And then I realized as I was doing that in that scene, I wasn't paying attention to what he was saying.
Right.
Like I was out of it.
Garfield's makeup and prosthetics, he still looks like a young guy. Because Garfield is...
He looks like a young guy in old man makeup.
Right. And it's almost like watching Johnny Knoxville in Bad Grandpa or something like that. Even though I would argue that makeup... I would argue...
You think the Knoxville makeup is better?
I think the Knoxville makeup on Bad Grandpa is better than Garfield's makeup in Tammy Faye. And listen, but also, that's not really a bad thing, because the people who do the makeup for those Jackass films are brilliant. Like those are state-of-the-art prosthetics. But the only reason I made the Bad Grandpa comparison is because Knoxville's a younger guy who was playing an older man, just like Andrew Garfield. But in this case, Garfield's character... I saw Garfield the whole time, but Chastain, I saw Tammy Faye the whole time. I was taken by how much I felt for Tammy Faye's character. I didn't know a ton about it. And really all my mindset was the perception of who they were and what they did and the legal elements that they faced. So she passed away in 2007. He's still alive, right?
He's still
right.
He is, and he's out of prison now at this point.
I would have liked more about the trial and the media circus surrounding the trial.
Was
I felt like that was kind of glossed over.
Well, see, that's the thing. Chastain's a producer on this movie, and she didn't want to focus on that aspect of Tammy Faye's
life. It was her human.
At all. She wanted to focus on... Yeah, exactly. She wanted to make her compassionate. I understand that, and I think that works for this bit of the story, but you could tell a totally different Tammy Faye story that would get into all that controversial tabloid stuff and the court cases and what they did to the... You get a little bit of it when they start to like apologize to their followers for the things that they did. But
the movie makes
it
seem like Tammy Faye was kind of oblivious to what was going on in terms of that.
I don't know how accurate
that is.
Yeah,
and so...
I don't know.
I want to clarify that because... I come from a perspective of not knowing a ton about the story. So the movie makes it seem, and maybe I'm wrong on this, Sean, the movie makes it seem like Tammy Faye didn't know a ton about what was happening behind the scenes.
And right, that, and that, I don't think that's accurate.
Okay,
so to be honest with you,
okay, I agree with Sean. Right, well, then like
that's the way the movie.
And what's
portrayed
interesting
it.
Is, you know, any family that essentially got bilked by them is going to watch this movie and hate her, no matter what, you know, because they represent the money that they took from them. So I think you can also do a really, there is a documentary about it. It would make a much more interesting
called The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Yeah, that this is essentially.
I think like the mother played by the great Cherry Jones, who I love.
Oh, she's amazing.
I love her.
So good.
Is meant to kind of represent us and our skepticism.
Yeah.
Every step of the way, her mother, who is a devout Christian, basically asks, like, "Is like you're getting all this money from people who are supposed to be donating to the church, but you live in a mansion? Like what? Like that doesn't make sense to me."
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't know. I know how the movie wants me to feel about Tammy Faye Baker, but I don't know how I feel about Tammy Faye Baker. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'm convinced. Mm-hmm.
It's worth watching for Chastain alone. Absolutely. I think we all definitely agree.
Well,
with
and,
that.
And if anything, just like you said, she's going to be a part of the conversation. So you're going to want to know what people are talking
you're
about.
You're going to want to know, for God's sakes. All right. Alfre Woodard blend. We're going to celebrate the films of the acting legend. Kev, why don't you start us off? Where'd you go for Alfre Woodard blend?
I was in between two. And the only reason so originally I was thinking Primal Fear because she's the judge in that film. And I'll never forget we had Edward Norton on our show. And I hadn't seen that film in so long. And to revisit that, you just forget how much of a powerhouse everybody is in that movie. That's probably my favorite in terms of if I'm looking at her career, but I have just a personal story, which is not necessarily about her performance, just the movie itself. My dad was a big Star Trek fan growing up. So I remember like my dad and I, like when I was a kid, my dad would try to get me into Star Trek and like he'd love to watch the series. And then when they started bringing those, like the movies out in the 90s, I know there were movies before that, but like Star Trek First Contact was the one that I remember seeing with my dad, and I have a ticket for it, and she's in that film. And I just remember being able to interview her once and show her that ticket, and like it meant so much to her that I still had that ticket. And, you know, because like it's interesting because looking back on it, I haven't seen that movie since 1996. Since it came out, like I saw it with my dad in theaters at AMC Patrick Henry. And I remember interviewing her and going through my ticket stub collection. I was like, what do I have that Alfre was in? And that was it. And her reaction to that ticket was so, she was so blown away that I still had it.
So cool.
And it was, I don't know, to me, that's the only reason why that one would end up being my choice, because it's such a personal thing to me that my dad and I saw that movie, that I kept the ticket, that I got to show it to her, like, 25 years later, and what it meant to her. But if I'm talking performance, strictly performance, I mean, she has some like a great performance in Primal Fear. I mean, her career is incredible. Her filmography is incredible.
Well, you'll see what the audience picks.
She's also in C, the brand new show C. She's season 2 of C. She's in that show right now.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched that. That's Momoa, right?
Momoa. It's like the basic premise is that everybody in civilization,
Batista's in the new season too.
Yeah, everyone's blind, right? Everyone's lost sight, and they two twins.
From what I understand, that's Momoa's group, but I don't think that's the case for Batista, who's being introduced in this. I don't know.
Okay,
I've heard it's good though. I also haven't seen it, so I guess I'm talking out of my ass.
And Francis Lawrence is involved in that, I believe.
If you can't see the people, why didn't they get John Cena?
Oh, see, that's really good.
Wrong wrestler, you're right.
You know, it kind of reminds me of Children of Men a little bit, because
it looks like it.
It looks like Children of Men.
Yeah, because the series basically is that the civilization can't see, and then twins are born that have born with sight, and that becomes a whole thing, just like Children of Men, where nobody could be, you know, women couldn't give, or weren't having babies anymore, and then the character gets pregnant. It kind of reminds me of that a little bit.
Yeah. Wait a second, I don't want to divert. But there's a news item that we missed this week. Sorry, Gabe, to go completely off the rails. Did you guys see that Triplets is moving forward? Ivan Reitman is doing Triplets, but he's not doing it with Eddie Murphy now.
Triplets is.
This is the sequel to Twins.
Like the sequel to Twins?
It's the sequel to Twins, and it's Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito coming back.
No.
And they were going to find out that there was a third sibling, and the third sibling was supposed to be played by Eddie Murphy. Yeah. For years, they had Eddie Murphy on the hook.
Okay, that's pretty funny, actually.
To do this premise.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Okay, but...
But do you need to see a whole movie, or can we just say the premise and that's enough enjoyment?
Or just do like a 30-minute short film or something like that. I feel like...
Maybe. But after the success of Coming to America, Murphy can't do it. And for years, it was Schwarzenegger, DeVito, and Murphy. And so now it's Tracy Morgan. And that now I really kind of feel like, with all due respect to Tracy Morgan... Pull the plug on this.
Well, I guess
like, we don't have to.
The difference there is that
Eddie Murphy does raise the profile.
Eddie's like iconic
100%. In every way.
I love Tracy Morgan, but like Eddie makes sense in that group because that Arnold group, and Danny are like legendary actors, and like I also feel like I remember reading Arnold's book. Arnold wrote a book a few years back. And I believe he said that he made the most...
I'll be book.
I'll be book. I don't know why he didn't call it that. That's actually a really good idea. I'll be book. That's pretty good. That was good.
Thank you.
That was really good. I don't know why he didn't call it that.
That's a real missed opportunity.
That's a really missed... But in the book...
Oh my God, the show.
In the book, he talks about how much money he made on Twins, because Twins was the first, I think at that point in his career, he decided to take a little bit up front, or like minimum up front, and then get a percentage of the box office on the back end. Mm-hmm. And I believe he said he made the most money of his career on that film, on Twins, because he took the back end of the box office. And Twins was, what year was Twins? Because was Twins after Terminator 2 and all this stuff?
I did not expect the show to go on a deep dive about height. Twins.
During the Alfred Woodard section.
Yeah,
Jesus. I didn't mean to do that. Yes, anyway, I tried to throw that news item out there. Kevin, I went with Primal Fear, so I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, because, go ahead. And it's a great character, and, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, look, if I was picking my favorite movie that she's involved in, it's Captain America Civil War, but her part is so small. And so I didn't feel that was warranted.
A lot of people did bring up that bit, though.
It's actually an important role.
And it's very important.
Yes, it is a very important role, but I feel like that would have been shortchanging her career if I went with that in that direction.
And you could argue for an important role in such an emotional moment that is so small, it requires someone of her caliber.
For sure.
Which is,
that's very, very true.
A special piece of
it. Also why Redford's so good in that movie, too. Wait,
yep, you're
about Winter Soldier, right?
No, she approaches Tony Stark backstage during Civil War and confronts him because her son died in the Battle of Sokovia.
I totally, that's such a great scene. Oh my
God. In the course of like two and a half minutes, she's like devastating.
No, but honestly,
it's a great scene. It's what triggers the launch of the Civil War. Accords and the Civil War.
That wouldn't have been a bad choice.
But I went with Primal Fear because Primal Fear to me, not only is it a great example of, it's a terrific story with a terrific, twist that if people don't know, we won't reveal it here, but it reminds me very much of, I've been watching recently The Fugitive. I hadn't seen The Fugitive in forever. The Fugitive reminds me so much of, the types of movies that they made at that time, of which Primal Fear is one of them, in that there was no throwaway role. You just populated it with really strong character actors, right? Like everyone in Fugitive is good. So even when like Joey Pants gets, you know, a scene, he knocks it out of the park because he's Joey Pantoliano. Primal Fear is incredible. Like it's mostly Ed Norton and Richard Gere, but you get Laura Linney, you get Alfred Woodard in these scenes so that when she has that big showcase scene where she's in her chambers between her and Gere, it's everything. It's fantastic. And so I love that she is part of that ensemble. I think the movie is fantastic. And so that's why I went in that direction. Jakey, where'd you go?
I chose Love and Basketball.
Oh, that just celebrated 20 years.
I love that. My sister loves that movie. So I watched that movie a lot with her growing up. It was one of her favorite movies. She had the poster on her wall. And, you know, I remember even when I was younger watching that with her and always thinking, oh, that's really cool that they gave the... So basically, she plays the mother of this character who... Her daughter is super into basketball and really wants to keep playing and progress through life, and her mom's just not supportive of it. She's not supportive of that dream. And finally, there's this really great kind of come-to-Jesus moment later in the film where she gets to explain like why she's not supporting her daughter's dreams of playing basketball. And it really takes what could have been just a very two-dimensional, paper-thin parent character that we've seen before, like the, oh, you're not going to go, you know, and adds this depth and dimension that really makes you go, oh, I get it. I get why she is kind of knocking her. Like, it gives depth to her past, which justifies her actions. She does what I think she has done many times. You look at 12 Years a Slave, where she plays like a very small part, but fleshes it out more so than most actors could ever do. But I remember thinking really at a young age, and because I love that movie too, like, wow, she took a character that could have been nothing if it were someone else and made it not just something, but something great.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely agree. All right, audience picks. Dave Hammer, Michael Breen, John Palmer, and many, many others went with Star Trek First Contact.
That's cool.
Rachel Ho said Love and Basketball. Jake Skelly went with Heart and Souls. Megs said Clemency. Kesha George says too many to choose from, but they really liked Juanita and the consistency of her role in Luke Cage.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Her career has been extremely impressive. For next week, we're going to play hashtag Mike Flanagan blend. So let us know.
No!
Let us know your picks. That's easy.
Damn you, Gabriel.
That's easy.
And why are we playing Mike Flanagan?
Because Flanagan is coming back to the show. We can announce it, right? It's in the can. We did.
Yeah, it happened. It's in the can.
Yeah, so we've spoken to Mike Flanagan on behalf of his Netflix show coming out called Midnight Mass. I think it comes out next week, right? It starts streaming.
Yes.
Is it a 7-episode dump?
Yep.
I think so. It's Netflix. It's Netflix.
The show Midnight Mass drops on Friday. That episode will drop Friday morning.
It's spoiler free.
It is spoiler free. We were very explicit. It's him and his producer and longtime partner, Trevor Macy, producing partner. And there are plenty of ground rules. We're kind of just following the marketing. It's a fantastic conversation.
The first question we talk about is how difficult it is of a show to talk about.
For sure.
The conversation is fantastic, and we even allude to at the end of, like, they need to come back so we can talk spoilers because it's that good.
But. And we do reach a level of lunacy that's pretty much on par with Fake of Tremblay.
Yeah, if anybody...
catch up on that if you haven't listened to that his first trip on The Real Blend.
We had him on for almost 2 hours, by the way. If anybody listening to us for the first time, just seek that interview out. It was an hour and 52 minutes. I'll never forget it. We did it during the pandemic, which I know we're still in the pandemic, but we did it last year. It was Dr. Sleep. We did it for like a Dr. Sleep.
The
director's cut.
Right. Yeah. And it was, we got to a point in that interview where we were talking about the Jacob Tremblay scene, which became we learned about Fake Up Tremblay and the puppet they used for that scene. and that comes up again in this interview. So if you want to be like in full context with this interview, like Gabe said, listen to the first one.
Listen
so you can
to
get
that one first.
Yeah. The sequel requires it.
Using hashtag Mike Flanagan Blend. You can also email us at cinemablend. No, realblend@cinemablend.com. realblend@cinemablend.com. And that's where this week's review comes from. Or maybe it was posted to our Apple.
This was on iTunes.
This was on iTunes.
Or Apple Podcasts.
All right. So Low Fidelity gives us 3 stars out of 5 and calls us Altman dummies. Now, this is going back to a conversation we had a long time ago.
This has been in there for a while.
And I don't remember why we were talking about Robert Altman. But I think all three of us kind of admitted that we'd not seen his Western, McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yeah.
And I have since then rectified that. I watched it and I thought it was terrific. But Low Fidelity writes, watch McCabe and Mrs. Miller and then I'll listen to your opinion seriously. Unbelievable. That's the whole review.
That's it?
Still gave us 3 stars.
To be fair, we pissed him off that much, but we still got 3 stars. So
true.
We must have liked.
True.
And now Sean has seen the film.
Inspired myself to go see it. So
maybe if they're still here, give us an updated, you know, 4th, 5 star, add a star, add 2 stars.
Bump us
Let
up.
Us know.
Give us something else to watch, Low Fidelity, while you're at it. Our next premium episode. Gabe, can you explain what we're going to be doing on this premium episode?
Yes, our next premium episode is, I think, going to be a fun one, and it's a bit of a pilot program, is what I'm calling it. We're testing to see how the format works. We're doing a tier list of Spider-Man movies, so people at home are probably familiar with the tier list concept. We're gonna rate Spider-Man films from
We have to come up with a collective answer? the collective real blind answer?
We'll find out. We'll find out. We're just going to throw ourselves into it and we'll see where we end up. But yeah, I mean, we have to agree where we're going to put it. That's
all right. Well, then I advise everybody to make a Spider-Man movie tier list on your own.
Yeah, so yeah, go check out, subscribe to Premium, and there'll be links in that show's description with where you can get your own tier list to play along, an image with our final tier list that you can look at, all that kind of stuff.
All right, sounds good. You can get information on the Premium at cinemablend.com/RealBlendPremium. Find the rest of us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, and at Gabe Kovach. The show is at Real Blend, and we will be back next week with Mike Flanagan and more goodness. So until then, Dual West Side Story. Oh! Ah! All right.
Just like first and second place, guys.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.